Recording has started.
Great. Thanks, Karen. Well, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to all, and welcome to the IGO, INGO Access to Curative Risk Protection Mechanisms Working Group call on the 3rd of August at 1600 UTC. On the call today, we do have George Kirikos, Phil Corwin, Petter Rainforth, Mason Cole, Jay Chapman, Paul Tattersfield. We do have apologies from David Maha. From ICANN staff, we do have Mary Wong, Dennis Chang, Steve Chan, Barry Cobb, and myself, Michelle Desire. As a reminder to everyone, please, for transcription purposes, please state your name before speaking, and please utilize your mute button when not speaking. I would now like to turn the call back over to Petter Rainforth.
Thank you, Petter here. Let's start with any updates on statements of interest. And as usual, I see no hands up. So then we proceed to the agenda of today. And may I first initially refer to Steve's email that he noted that it's Doug's understanding that this action item is expected once the working group pares down to the options, referring to the impact analysis document. And as Steve said, we are now up to six options, to a core set of options that it feels worth consideration for final recommendation. And as well, Paul noted after that he thinks that options are not so numerous to warrant any weeding out, and he thought that they can all be addressed. Well, I don't disagree with any of you, but I note what Steve said, and first of all, we need to quickly come up with to a conclusion and hopefully agree about one possible solution, meaning that we at least will have a majority decision on one proposal to present to the GSO Council. And, I think I mentioned once, when I was in the Council, there was a working group, and luckily I was not a member of that, who could not come up with one proposal but presented two possible versions in their final report, and that was indeed not possibly taken. So, and I think we can come up with at least, as I said, a majority decision. I also participated in a working group that there was a majority decision, and I have to admit that I was the only one that noted a personal objection to one specific point, and just to formally note that I did not agree to all recommendation, but it was officially a majority, 99% majority solution, and well, let's try to avoid that as well, but just mention it as a possibility if we get the majority and thereby official final recommendation. So my goal of today's meeting is to further discuss option five, Paul Keating's, and then option six, George's latest recommendation. And then I would like to see if we can summarize the six options to hopefully get the number down a bit. I think it can be dealt with by, in fact, handle some of the additional options as further developments and suggestions related to option one and or option two. As we have discussed in previous meetings, some of the proposals are actually possible to at least to discuss and consider when it comes to both option one and option two. And before I leave it out to you, George, you said by email that paring down the options prematurely without doing the risk assessment seems to be a step in the wrong direction. To make my suggestion clear, I don't suggest that we will not update the risk assessment. However, I hope that we can add some of the added options into 1 and 2, and from that make an update of the risk assessment. And I agree that we shall not just at these calls make a final yes or no to any of these suggestions. Of course not. So, George, over to you.
George Kirkus for the transcript. Yes, I just wanted to speak on that last point about the risk assessment. I think on our schedule we have a consensus call at some point, I think it was in September, to decide, you know, which option we're going to go with. So as long as the risk assessment is done before that, before we make a final decision, that's my only concern, because we shouldn't be creating the risk assessment after we've already made a decision. It kind of puts the cart before the horse. We should do the risk assessment, and that'll provide us with the information and the analysis we need to actually do the paring down of the options to the final ones. And actually, if we look at the options, there's some overlap. Like option number 4 really builds on options 1 and 2, so there's some overlap. And options 6 and 3 are relatively slim options, so they're not. They're not necessarily very complicated in terms of the analysis compared to, say, options 1 or options 2. Thanks.
Thank you, George. And I take that as you agree with me that we can make it perhaps add or as you noted, to make some of the additional options more more not so complicated, as they are not not all of them are actually complete new proposals. They are related to some of the details, and as I also noted, some of them could be and will be possible to further discuss, both related to option 1 and option 2, as most of them actually talking about the court deal, so which will be in any way the first or the only step if you want to act against a UGRP or URS decision. Okay, unfortunately, Paul is not here today, yes, Mary.
Go ahead, Peter. I'll go after you're done.
Okay, thanks. We'll see. I just wanted to set it, well, Paul sent out an email that he apologized to he wasn't able to complete the task, and then I replied in hope that he could have the possibility to send something updated for the meeting today, but obviously the work continued. So I still want to go through Paul's suggestion, and then we'll have to decide if we want to treat this as a specific option or as I more see it, perhaps as something related to option 1 or option 2, as we don't have any more details there. So that was my first view on that, and then over to Mary.
Thank you very much, Peter. Everybody, this is Mary from staff. So the staff have been trying to work through each of these options, and as noted in the chat, we did send a note to Paul Keating to see if he could be on today's call, or alternative, if he wasn't able to, if he could provide some clarity and clarification in writing to the list, in particular because George and others have provided feedback. So the first thing is we can probably follow up with him, especially if on the call today, as Petter has suggested, you do discuss each of these options, and it does seem to be a good thing for us to be able to work through all of the options. The second thing to note is that, as I said, the staff have been trying to work through these and to sort of really understand what some of the potential ramifications are, not just for the UDRP or the URS, but in the sense of the whole process following a determination by a panel. Since none of us on the staff supporting this group are really legal process experts, much less litigators, I know Paul and others are, one suggestion that we would like to bring up for your consideration is, given that we're looking at a couple of weeks break for us to start drafting the final report, whether it would be whether it would be acceptable for us to ask our legal colleagues to go through these options, not to provide an opinion as to which is preferable. That is something the working group needs to do, but to provide at least internally some clarity of process in terms of things like costs and feasibility from a litigation-based perspective. So that was it from me, Petter. Thanks.
Thanks, Mary. And as stated by both you and George, it's important that we in our working group make our own comments on each topic. But if your internal legal experts, without causing any extension of time, if they have the possibility to just make some neutral legal notes, I think that could be of assistance for us all. And then again, we make our own conclusions based on that and based on our experience and the inputs we have from others. George.
George Krikos for the transcript. Yeah, just to briefly discuss Paul's proposal. His proposal is basically to do nothing because, in his view, the policy would allow the domain registrant to sue the ADR provider, i.e. WIPO or NAF or the other Asian or Czech arbitration providers. But his premise was that was based on the fact that the UDRP rules don't have the same certification for domain owners, the registrants who are the respondents in the UDRP, that are made for the complainants. However, the ADR providers do have that same equivalent language in their supplemental rules. And so when I initially analyzed his proposal, the same day he made it, I pointed that out, so the premise appeared faulty. However, upon further analysis, as I pointed out earlier this week on Monday, the UDRP rules actually define what supplemental rules are, and conceivably, those additional words that the UDRP providers are making the domain owner agree to might fall outside the permissible supplemental rules. So that might revive Paul's understanding. But the other point I wanted to make is that his proposal is somewhat consistent with my new proposal number six, or option number six, because it's basically trying to accomplish the same thing, preserve the respondent's court action to not necessarily be involving only the IGO. Paul's solution would be to drag the ADR provider into the case. My solution would be to just have a quasi-in-rem or in-rem action instead of in personam action. So they're very consistent with one another, just based on different aspects of the EDRP rules. Thank you.
Thanks. And then, George, sorry if I missed out, but then we referred to Paul's option 3 rather than option 5.
Sorry, no, option number 5, he's basically saying that the respondent in the EDRP, i.e. the domain name owner, could still sue WIPO in the court to overturn the EDRP decision. So let's say the IGO is UNESCO, and the domain owner would normally sue UNESCO in court to halt the adverse EDRP ruling. Paul's solution would be that the domain owner can sue WIPO or NAF or whoever is UDRP provider in order to overturn the decision. So they would bring them to court. That was my understanding of what. So it's a distinct difference from option number 3, which is only saying that there's a limited waiver with regards to the type of immunity that the IGO is waiving. In fact, option number 3 is kind of consistent with my option number 6 as well, because it's trying to achieve that in rem or quasi in rem solution, where only the outcome of the domain name is at stake, and not any other issues. Thanks.
Thanks. And I see Mary's note in the chat room that George, won't there be a concern with jurisdictions that don't recognize one of these legal bases in rem quasi best known for domain names. So we may inadvertently favoring some jurisdictions over others. And, well, that may be one possible problem. The other is that in order to, well, first of all, we have to also have in mind that when it comes to registrars, even if it may not be clear in the UDRP or the URS, but in all registrars agreements, the domain holder agrees that they will not hold the registrar harmless, that they will hold the registrar harmless in a dispute. So that's actually something that you agree about when you register a domain name. And I'm not so sure when it comes to the, well, when it comes to also add WIPO or the forum in a court, because it's related to a domain dispute. And at least not in all jurisdictions, the court will agree that the organization that have arranged for the dispute resolution process before, they could be a part in that court decision. So, but again, Mary's suggestion to reach out to ICANN's internal legal experts, this could be one of the topics to further consider that, too, so that we have a more clear response to that. And I just wait to see Mary's comment in. Yeah, thanks. Mary, confirm that she will contact legal and let us know the result. So this is one of the topics that I think it's perfect for the legal expert internal to have a look at. And And okay, so I see on the schedule we have the option 3 up, and we have discussed this before. I don't see that we need to further consider it today. But looking at the summary, it's stating on the possibility to obligate the respondent to waiving any monetary claims. And if I speak personally, I think that's something that we should consider further to see if we can put it in both option 1 or 2. And then we have let me scroll here. Yes. Option 4 that we discussed last meeting. And again, I personally see us as one thing we should put in independent on our final decision is to have a specific date when we can there will be a group to look at the solution and see what's how it has worked and what may be needed and I'll just wait to see if Phil is typing.
And George says only option.
Only option 6 has to be discussed at George's states, and that was actually what I was coming to in as the next step here. And well, George, it's your option, so I'll leave it over to you to make a short presentation of it.
Okay, George Kirikos for the transcript. I was just going to suggest that if Phil's typing something really long, he might hit return so that he can split what he's saying into two parts and give us a sense of where he's trying to go in case he has something to say. Skype isn't working, can't access his sound card, maybe Adobe's causing that. He's going to try to reboot and come back. So should I proceed with a discussion of option number 6?
Yep.
Okay. George Kirikos again for the transcript. So basically, option number 6 is trying to preserve the right of the registrant to a court action while simultaneously limiting the IGO's immunity. So this topic actually came up a couple of weeks ago when we were running the various scenarios on what would happen if a court action was filed after an adverse UDRP decision, and we were talking about whether the registrar would lock the domain name or transfer the domain name, and under what conditions they would be forced to make the transfer of the domain name. And by the written language of the UDRP, as I stated in my email, which I'll post the link to in the chat room, it has specific language that says the registrar won't do anything unless you've commenced a lawsuit, and then the keywords are against the complainant in a jurisdiction to which the complainant has submitted. And so that recognizes the that the case should be in personam because it's named against the complainant. You could, as I pointed out in the email, the wording of that section is very poorly written because it doesn't even say that the litigation has to be about the domain name. You could have, you know, if it's UNESCO, you could sue them for something unrelated to the domain name. You could sue them for fraud or sue them for some employment action or some other cause of action that's made up. And by the letter of the EDRP rules, the registrar would be obligated to stop the transfer, even though the lawsuit doesn't involve the domain name. So it's kind of a nonsensical paragraph, but that's how it's written. Anyhow, my proposal was that we could change that language slightly and improve it to say that you've commenced a lawsuit, and here's the keywords, concerning the domain name in a jurisdiction to which the complainant has submitted. And what that'll effectively do is allow the respondent in the EDRP, i.e. the domain name owner, to sue in court both in personam, i.e. named against the IGO, or via quasi in rem or an in rem procedure, or probably best of all, do more than one of them. So they would sue in personam, naming the IGO, but also against the domain name itself, i.e. in rem, quasi in rem. And so in the event that the IGO asserts immunity and gets themselves dismissed from the case, the action would still proceed because the entire action hasn't been dismissed, i.e. the in rem aspect or the quasi in rem aspect would survive. And so this would eliminate the need for arbitration or eliminate the need to consider vitiating or nullifying the court decision. It eliminates the route to option number one or option number two because the action in the courts is still alive. It hasn't been extinguished. And so the registrant still has the recourse in the courts, i.e., albeit in the in rem or the quasi in rem aspect only. And so that kind of interacts with a bit on option number three. And it also interacts a little bit in terms of option number five, because that's effectively what Paul Keating's trying to accomplish by his solution, i.e. suing the registrar or the ADR provider, although my solution doesn't require either the registrar or the ADR provider to be brought into court at all. It only allows the RGO or the property itself, i.e. the domain name, to be sued. And so one can go further than the proposal that I've mentioned in terms of limiting it only to disputes involving IGOs, but we could conceivably be more aggressive and just change the language for all disputes to permit in rem basis to freeze the status by the registrar. I think when the framers of the EDRP created it, they didn't actually contemplate that anybody would sue other than in personam. And so this wasn't something that would normally have come up in their analysis, and so we'd be correcting it for potentially all disputes. However, we could constrain it to only involve disputes involving IGOs if we wanted to be conservative, and then rely upon the other PDP on the RPMs, which is analyzing the ERP, and we could correct it there 2 or 3 years from now. And so that's basically the summary of it. So if anybody had any thoughts and questions, I think Mary had raised the point earlier about whether all courts would recognize an in rem or quasi in rem cause of action. I spoke to my own lawyer about this a couple weeks ago or last week, and yeah, she was clear that at least in Ontario, Canada, where domain names are property and the domain name is registered to an Ontario registrant, and is at an Ontario registrar, in my case, two cows, then the in rem solution would certainly be viable. If the scenarios were slightly different, Conceivably, it may not be possible to do it under those under those mutual jurisdictions. But I think if the registrant, say for a .com domain, sued in Virginia, they would always have in rem jurisdiction over those domains because it would be at the registry level. So that would probably need a further adjustment in terms of it being outside the jurisdictions to which the complainant has submitted. So, but that would go further than my proposal. Thank you.
Thanks. Peter here. Just a couple of initial thoughts about this. When you use an in-rem action, it can only be accepted by a court when the court has authority over the property, so to speak, or when the court jurisdiction extends to cover it. And therefore, as the location of the property is important, I would say that yes, it's possible to use it, but as I see it initially, it will be automatically limited to the jurisdiction of the registrar, not where the domain holder is, because it needs to be further identified what is the location of the property, but I presume that will be where the domain name actually is registered. So having said that, in rem actions are of course from the start created to cases where the other part cannot be properly identified, but as also we could see from George's cases, it has been used also between parties, and there's more or less when the court says that there are two identified parties, the court presumes that the other party is not the true owner, and therefore this procedure can be used accordingly. As said, in rem is still basically when the party that you sue cannot be identified correctly. So I take this topic as something to add internal legal experts to see if it has been used and what, from a legal point of view, could be the risks and possibilities, and also if thinking about the court, from what I know so far, the in rem action as such are accepted in most courts of the world. So from that point of view, it's a possibility. George, your hand is up.
George Kirkus for the transcript. You'd mentioned a couple of seconds ago about the in rem procedure being used when the other parties can't be identified. I think that's occasionally the case, but it's not necessarily limited to those situations. The person using the in rem mechanism might simply to only have the outcome of the property itself, the rightful ownership, be decided, and not want to have any extraneous issues be decided, which might be, you know, to the advantage of the IGO, because, you know, they guard their immunity in many cases. And so in some ways, making this change actually benefits the IGOs, because to the extent that the current language of the EDRPA, the 4K, compels the domain name owner to sue in personam, it's kind of, it would take away the option of suing in rem, as, or at least it doesn't necessarily take it away, but it makes it less clear what would happen. By making clear what would happen, i.e. that the registrar would be compelled to stop the transfer, which might already be the case, because I think from talking to my own registrar, at least, they would stop the transfer, like they would freeze everything pending the resolution of all litigation, i.e. EDRP-related or not EDRP-related. As long as there's litigation, they would freeze the outcome. And so by simply making this clarification, then it might actually make it better for both the domain name registrant not having to necessarily use the in persona mechanism. They can just simply rely on the in-rem mechanism. The way the in-rem mechanism works is that the domain name owner, if it was a domain dispute, would still give notice to interested parties. So they couldn't just file an in-rem lawsuit and not give notice to the IGO or to other people that are interested in the outcome of the property. They would still have to give that notice, but then it would be up to the IGO to decide whether they want to intervene and make representations to the court. And in that kind of scenario, their actual downside is limited because they themselves are not being sued. It's just the outcome of the domain name's property that is left to be resolved by the court. Thanks.
Thanks. I just looking at the ICANN policy paragraph 4K dealing with the registrar's responsibilities. And if this system is used, I think that also needs to be rephrased, because it's talking about the 10 days for the registrar to wait before implementing the decision, and it still says the cancellation transfer is if order will take place unless appropriate legal action is commenced against the complainant within the 10-day period, not against the domain name itself. Also, if the transfer is stopped within this 10-day period in order to release that, the registrar will not take any further action until they have received other satisfactory evidence of resolution between the parties. And if you use this system, there will be not two parties, only one, the domain holder, or satisfactory evidence that the lawsuit has been dismissed or withdrawn, meaning that the transfer of the domain name to the complainant, or a copy of a court order dismissing the lawsuit or ordering that the party does not have the right to continue to use the domain name. So it's this must also be rephrased if this system is used. But as said, I think this is a new idea that we need some further legal input from, and then we have identified two topics for ICANN's internal legal group to consider, and even if I took Mary's initial suggestion correctly, they will look briefly on each comment and topic and solutions that we have discussed. But these two specific topics, I think, is new and indeed a little bit more legally difficult for us to make a decision on without any further input. Mary, your hand's up.
Thanks, Petter, and thanks to you and George for continuing the dialogue and for summarizing as well. If I could ask you to repeat what you think that the second thing we might want to ask ICANN Legal about, and the reason I ask is because what we had suggested as staff earlier really was to just ask them to look at the various options from a legal procedural perspective and give us, you know, any sort of thoughts they might have about, you know, feasibility, practicality, costs, and so forth. When we speak of the UDRP and URS or the rules and the language, I know that I think Phil and others had pointed out that this may be something that will have implications for the RPM review that's a separate PDP. So one thing I did want to say there was that to the extent our working group makes a recommendation about text and language, we probably would need to consider whether or not that's something that can be limited or should be limited just to this IGO scenario, because if not, then it's probably something that goes to the other working group. And so my question in that context, Petter, is I wasn't sure of the second item you mentioned related to that or to something else. Thank you.
Thanks. Well, yes, I perfectly agree with you that if we actually goes into the policies and such, not just the keep it as it is today, or with the recommendations we have had in option two, then our work is more or less more related to the other working group that will consider first the URS and then the UDRP. And although I personally want to avoid that, because then it will be some further large extension of time unless we until we can come out with a conclusion, we or in cooperation with other working group. But I if we could make the your internal legal expert, if they could have some kind of comments just on the in-rem topic, maybe if it has been used within ICANN disputes, or if they just can make some general comments on that, so that we have something to some further facts that we can add to our continued discussion, and I don't know if they can. Well, I presume that they are not either IGO experts, but just some general input on the in-rem suggestion. And I'll leave it to that, and I'll see if they say that that's too difficult to come out with. Then we have to accept that, but if they have the possibility to just make a quick and clear input from a pure legal point of view. Yes, George.
George Rikos, for the transcript, I just wanted to bring out bring people's attention to paragraph 3B of the EDRP, and I sent a link in the chat room, which is actually broader than the language in 4K. In paragraph 3B, it says We will cancel transfer or otherwise make changes to domain name registrations under the following circumstances. And B is a receipt of an order from a court or arbitral tribunal, in each case of competent jurisdiction, requiring some action. So there they just refer to an order from a court. It doesn't necessarily involve in personam or in rem. It could be either. It could be both. So somehow the in personam got into 4K, but it didn't necessarily need to be in order to be consistent with the rest of the policy. And on Monday, I actually went through both the rules and the to see in detail if anything else would have needed to be changed. And I think nothing else would need to be changed. It would only require 4K to be modified by those slight words and or additional words at the end of the 4K as Petter specified. So I just wanted to point out that language of 3B. Thanks.
Thanks, Orchard. I hear what you say, but I'm not so sure what that court order would actually state if not that the domain name should be kept with the original domain holder. I mean, if the court says that no, the complainant in the court action, which is probably the domain holder, has no rights to the domain name. So who has the better rights? There is no counterpart identified. We're just talking about the domain name as itself. So that's my... I note the part of the policy that you refer to, but I'm not so sure that it's possible to use if it's not the court order, it's not actually stating, identifying a part that that has the right to the domain name. Yeah, well, I note in the chat, George has said that in REM or quasi, and in REM would simply determine the rightful owner of a domain name, not other aspects. Again, from a legal point of view, if yeah, well, it seems to me not a clear legal base for it. As said, we need to discuss this further, and hopefully we'll also. I mean, we are not so many on this meeting, but we are, as we identified last meeting, we are. Much larger number of members of the working group. So this is also a topic to send out to everyone to have some further inputs on the following couple of weeks. And having said that, I just wanted to let's go on to the number of options as it was discussed. In the beginning, if we actually have five options, or if it could be used in a more limited, and here again is my personal conclusion, but I see that option three is, as I see it, related to option one, but. Adding the possibility to waive any monetary claims. So the question is if we can add that as a possible addition to option one, as well as consider it as part of option two, instead of dealing with it as a separate option. I think it's we can definitely at a wish when we send out. The new topics for for consideration with the plus and minus. This could be added to both option, or basically to option one, because option two is referring to option one with some additions. So that's what I see with option three. And then we have option four, that's relating to option two, but with additional suggestions. And I suggest that we add that as a further possible version of option two, maybe as an option 2B rather than a completely independent option. If okay, you say it relates to option one, Lou. So, okay, default is option one, but option two for some names. Yes, so, but if you can just give an okay in the chat, George, that we can treat it as a part of option one and two for further comments, just to put the number of options. Yes, excellent. Okay, and then we have option four, which I... Yes, that was option four. Option five. I see it as an addition to option one, and just further comments to consider in relation to option one. And George suggests that we should phone Paul. Well, I'm not sure if we should phone him, but maybe send him a final reminder, just in order to see if he still as he noted that he, based on our discussions and so, wanted to rephrase option five, and. As I have not seen anything of that, I'm not sure that he's still in favor of option five. But let's send him a final reminder that he can come in with some additions or remarks in option five, or at least state if he still wants option five to be considered, and. If he accept that, I see it as an addition to option one. And then option six. It's also related to option one and two, but I'm not sure that we need to treat that as a separate option. But I'm free to discuss that. And then I turn out to George again. Okay, good. Option six relates to option three, too. Meaning that, do you see this? Because option three, we have said already that it relates to option one and two. So is option six something that we can also add to option one and two? If that's then we actually have additional suggestions made to the two original options, and if we can agree about that, I think it's the best way to work on it, rather than to see completely separate options. As I said initially, I see most of these additional suggestions are related to one or two of the initial options to further amend or to add comments on that. George.
Yeah, George Kourikos, again, for the transcript. Yeah, I was just going to say for option number 6 and perhaps for option number 3 as well, they're not an either-or situation with regards to option number 1 and number 2. For option number 6 in particular, it's actually trying to reduce the number of scenarios that can happen to get to option number 1 or number 2. Option number 1 or number 2 only happen in specific cases where the court action is dismissed and we ask what happens next. Option number 6 tries to keep the in rem aspect of the case still going, which gives the domain name owner the recourse in the courts and says, and so you don't necessarily get to the scenario for option number 1 or number 2, except in, you know, even more limited scenarios where the in rem aspect or the quasi in rem aspect didn't survive. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, George. So, but as I see, we can add it to the further discussion of option 1 and 2. And as you said, it was further limit the possible number of court actions. And we have already recognized that it will be very limited number of initial domain disputes, and even more limited number that will be taken to the second phase, so to say, to courts. So if I have an option that will further limit it, I presume that we may see one of these cases every 3 or 4 years or so. Okay. Thanks. That was an excellent meeting, very practical. And then I turn over to Mary on the updated schedule that we can see what we have in front of us.
Yep. Hi, Petter and everyone. This is Mary again from staff. This is the same timeline that was shared last week. We haven't made any changes to it. And obviously, progress on this timeline does depend on a number of things. First, the staff would need to have a draft final report for you. Given where we are with recommendation 4 and the various options, it's very likely as of today that we will probably still need to do quite a bit of work as a group on the final language there. But the idea is to have the next 2 weeks or so for us to at least have as much of a final draft of a draft as possible. And all this leads up, obviously, to the Abu Dhabi meeting, ICANN 60, where presumably the final recommendations, such as they are, will be discussed with the community. And, of course, the final piece here, which Phil said last week, is a decision to be made by the group once you've seen the draft final report, is whether it would make sense to publish it for public comment before submitting it to the GNSO Council. So hopefully that's helpful, Petter.
Thanks, Mary. And I perfectly understand that the initial dates of the timeline we'll see here will be changed a bit, put forward. But then, personally speaking, I don't see any necessary to ask for another wave of public comment. We'll see when we come up with our draft final report, but I hope that it will be of the kind that that we actually can conclude and make it as a final recommendation. And if I read the timeline correctly, whether or not we will have a possibility to get some inputs in Abu Dhabi, I see that we have in that schedule we have the publish before that. We'll see if we have time to send it out before Abu Dhabi. But in any case, we'll have some further inputs in Abu Dhabi, I presume. Yes, Barry.
Thanks, Peter. Just to follow up on that, and separate from the question of publishing the draft report for public comment, which is a decision to be made by the working group, one consideration that the group might want to take into account is that if you complete your final report before the end of October, the purpose of the community session in Abu Dhabi may be different depending on whether you will have already submitted it to the council by the meeting. Because if you have, then it's basically, you know, a finalized report and it won't be changed. If you hold off submitting it till after Abu Dhabi, then it does mean that community input in Abu Dhabi, again, separate from any public comment you might do, can be used to inform the final text of the recommendations. So just another timeline-related factor to consider. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Agree upon that. Would it be possible, without spending too much extra time, to give out two versions of the timeline? I mean, we've seen this one here that will be extended a little bit on the initial dates. But it would be interesting also to see something if we actually don't have it prepared for a comment period before Abu Dhabi. What kind of new times that we relay on. It would be good also for us when we decide on how to work further. And, well, I see the last day here is December 11, and then after that all the holiday period starts. But hopefully if we come to the conclusion that we need Abu Dhabi for further direct input from participants there, I still hope that we can finalize this topic before the end of this year. But if possible, if you can just send out to the full working group two alternative timelines. Okay, George?
Yeah, George Kirikos for the transcript. I just had a quick question relating to that IGO small group. I noticed that there hadn't been any new postings since June. I'll send a link to the mailing list, sorry, to the chat room, regarding the IGOs and the council or the GAC members. And so I was curious if anything has been happening there that we're aware of. Sometimes silence can be a little bit concerning. You know, they might be discussing policies in secret, trying to circumvent our work. So I was curious if you know of anything else that's going on. Thanks.
Thanks. And I would say that I and Phil has not got any further input from that group since, well, we had some informal discussions with WIPO's representatives in South Africa, but there was nothing actually new to this topic. But Mary knows better than me on that.
Hi, everyone. It's Mary from staff again. Hardly so better. But as far as we know, the small group of the IGOs completed their work and discussions late last year. And so the small group proposal is what it is, that was sent to the GNSO and considered by this working group. In relation to any additional discussions that may have arisen as a result of the facilitated discussions in Copenhagen, as you see by the mailing list and as Petter said, we are not aware of any further discussions that are taking place between the various representatives. So there is some internal work going on in ICANN.org about some feasibility questions that were raised to us by that group about essentially an ongoing watch service for IGOs, which is not related to the work of this group. But besides that, we don't believe that there's any further updates or discussions.
Thanks, Mary. Now, the small group also discussed, I think, the group we had with representatives and also from the board, from IGOs and GAC, also related to the Red Cross and Olympic Committee's issues. As also George noted before, the group that deals with the pre-registration and list of Red Cross, Olympic Committee, and INGOs and IGOs, that report is more or less ready to be in force by the beginning of next year. So these issues are being put into place. Okay, so then we have all something to deal with the coming up 2 weeks, and I hope that we will also have an active participation on email by members that could not be on the meeting once we have come up with a summary of our topics and recommendations and options. Having said that, although we have more or less 20 minutes left of today's meeting, I think we can thank ourselves for good work and take a break. Well, thanks for today.
Thank you very much, Petter. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. Operator, would you mind stopping the recordings for us? And disconnect all remaining lines. Have a great day, everyone. Meeting adjourned.